from KMOX Sports.
Okay, boys, here we go.
Welcome to the Graybar Sports Open Line.
Those mid swings, and he hits a drive. He hits a slammer.
Graybar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs.
Here we go.
Now, Matt Pauly on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
All right, man, let's get going here.
Here we go. Let's go.
We have arrived to Monday. The weekend is over. The week is getting started, and it is a Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauly. I have you for the next 2 hours this evening. In some ways, 3 hours. We've got the Gas House Gang tonight from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, and on Mondays, it's always the four of us, myself along with Tom Ackerman, Kevin Wheeler, and Bernie Miklas. So that's going to be... We've got you covered. Nothing but sports here between now and 9 o'clock here on KMOX. We've got a busy hour this hour. A couple guests are going to join us. We're going to be joined by Gerard Hamilton. He covers Mizzou football for Power Mizzou. He's going to join us in about 10 minutes or so. And then later on this hour, we're going to be joined by Michael Yam, who covers the NFL for a few different media outlets, including Sirius XM Radio, NFL Network, does some stuff for the CW as well. So he's going to join us coming up later on this hour. Here's kind of the things that we're talking about today. From a baseball standpoint, the awards for Rookie of the Year are out in the National League. It is Paul Skenes. He beats out Jackson Merrill. If I would have been voting, I would have put Merrill in front of Skenes. Interestingly enough, of all 30 of the votes for those two guys were the only guys who received either first or second place votes. Every single person voting for National League Rookie of the Year voted for either Skenes or Merrill, one and or two respectively. So those two got nothing but first place and second place votes. Skenes did get 23 of the first place votes. It was Merrill getting 7, and Skenes wins the award. Really tough to differentiate. This was, man, there were a lot of really good rookies this year in the National League. This is how good the National League rookie class was. Mason Wynn does not get a single vote. Doesn't get a single vote. Only four total individuals get votes, period, which is the lowest number ever in the history of the award. On the American League side of things, Luis Gill wins the American League Rookie of the Year award. I am not trying to be dismissive of anything that Gill did this year, but without a doubt, Mason Wynn on his same season would have received votes in the American League, and I think you can easily make the argument that he could have won the American League Rookie of the Year award. So, yeah, that's the way things go. So Paul Skenes wins it on the National League side of things. Congratulations to him. Just what he did this year was incredible. I mean, unprecedented. The only reason I kind of put Merrill in front of him was because of what he was doing for a team that was winning at a high level down the stretch of the season. Those votes do go in to they're locked in before the postseason gets started, so it doesn't really matter what happens in the postseason. Those awards are locked in a little bit before that. The St. Louis contingent who voted, we had two St. Louis voters, Jeff Jones from the Belleville News Democrat, Benjamin Hockman from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. They both voted in the direction that it ended up going, where it was first place for Skenes, second place Merrill, and then third place Jackson Churio, who came in third from the Milwaukee Brewers, and that's the way that that all plays out. So we'll talk a little bit more about that coming up later on this hour and in the next hour as well. The new Hall of Fame ballot is out. Some interesting names on there for a first time. Some interesting names holding over as well. We'll go through that coming up as well. And if we have time, we might try to kind of jumpstart a conversation that you're going to hear later on during the Gas House Gang. What is the Cardinals' identity, and how does that impact fan enthusiasm? I think it's an interesting thing because, you know, sometimes if you're listening to this show, there's a good chance that you're a really big sports fan, and all you care about is if the Cardinals win or lose. And I appreciate that. There's nothing wrong with having that attitude, but that does not reflect like the overall population, right? So, if you're the Cardinals, what can you do to bring in more casual fans, to get more casual fans interested in what's going on? That kind of protects you if you're having a down season, where if all you care about is wins and losses, if the vast majority of people who show up to a game only care about wins and losses? Well, when you're losing more than you're winning, or if you're not winning enough, then attendance drops. We saw that over the last couple seasons. What kind of things can be done from a baseball standpoint that would impact kind of protecting yourself from that? And I do think it comes down to team identity. There's a conversation to be had, and I can tell you it's being had by individuals at the Cardinals about game day atmosphere and the things that they want to do at Busch Stadium. And I think that's important. You want the ballpark environment to be one that's fun, win or lose. It's still a ballpark. It's still entertainment. So that's not really where I'm going with this. It's more about the identity of the team and the things that you want out of the individual players and things like that. In many ways, the Cardinals, the way they've been put their head down and play baseball. And when you put your head down and play baseball, well, then if you're not winning, you don't really have much of an identity. And that's kind of what's happened, whereas opposed to other teams that are known for other things, even if they're winning or they're losing. So it's an interesting conversation to be had. We'll have it. We'll go pretty deep on that during the Gas House Gang this evening between 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock. But we may try to touch on that a little bit before we get to that point. As always, if you want to chime in with us, you can do so. 314-436-7900. That's how you call. That's how you text. You can tweet at me, at Matt Pauley on air. When we come back, we'll talk with Gerard Hamilton. He covers Missouri football for Power Mizzou, and he's with us in just a moment as we roll on. It's Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. It's Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauley, taking you until 8 o'clock this evening. It was an interesting game for Missouri football this past weekend. It's kind of, you know, you look through the Missouri season, and there have been some wins that you haven't felt great about. The Boston College win, the Vanderbilt win. And then there's a loss where maybe you feel a little bit better about your team than you do in those other games. And I think that would be a good descriptor for Saturday's loss at South Carolina, 34-30. To join us to talk about it a bit, he writes for Power Mizzou, powermizzou.com. He is Gerard Hamilton. You follow him on Twitter, at Gerard C. Hamilton. Gerard, always appreciate you spending a little time with us here on KMO. How are you?
Doing well. How you doing?
Doing all right. So what's your takeaway from that game where, I mean, that fourth quarter was crazy. Missouri takes a couple leads every time South Carolina, they had an answer. We saw some incredible plays made in that final quarter. That was a really, really entertaining final few moments of football.
Yeah, it's one of those losses where I know it kind of sung for the fans and obviously for the team, but I don't think it's, you know, as demoralizing as, you know, losses to A&M or Bama where a team doesn't show up or, you know, you have a major injury or something like that. It's like, it's just one of those games where it's like you realize the other team also has, you know, SEC scholarship players too. They're also a top 25 team, and they were ranked where they were ranked going into that game for a reason. So Missouri showed a lot of heart. That final offensive possession, well, the second to last offensive possession with Cook finding Burden, you know, kind of down that left sideline, and Burden makes the one hand catch. That's an amazing play, and it's, you almost feel bad for the defense because for the most part they've been keeping them in a lot of games this year, and so it's one of those things again. Like South Carolina has playmakers too. Lenora Sellers, big day, breakout day. Obviously Rocket Sanders and stuff like that. And so for this Missouri defense that's been so good for so long, you know, it just wasn't their day. And, you know, even though I think they were 8-0 in the last couple of years in one score games, I mean, yes, eventually I guess the team was, you know, going to break that streak. And so it's a heartbreaker for them, but it's just one where it's just like, I mean, it's kind of the game.
Do you give more credit to South Carolina offensively for their answers in the fourth quarter, or is there more blame for especially the secondary of Mizzou?
I mean, I think it came out yesterday or today. I've been writing a lot of stories, but I wrote that one of the turning points of the game was 3rd and 10, about 7 minutes left to go, and we think Johnny Walker's going to have his second sack, and Sellers breaks out of it. And he completes it to the tight end. The tight end just gets tackled right over the line to gain. Then the next play is the 54-yard gain completion Sellers had. Secondary struggled. I mean, all of them had their moments where it was just like, this is, it's not good. And some of the worst ball they played all year, this in the Texas A&M game, Nick DeLoach, he had a pretty bad day. He gave up a couple of 40-yard receptions, including that 54-yarder I just mentioned. Dre Norwood had a holding. He had a pass interference earlier in the game, had a holding that took away a sack. Dalen Carnell got beat on the deep ball for 43 yards. Marvin Burks was missing tackles. He had the blown coverage on the first touchdown. I mean, the secondary was not good whatsoever. But, again, South Carolina has to make those plays. They have to capitalize on that. It's not all on one side. So Missouri makes those mistakes, and South Carolina can't capitalize. And then what are we talking about? So it's a mix of both.
We know that Brady Cook is a tough, tough dude. Were you surprised that he ended up playing? And I mean, not that he had a great game, but, man, he went out there, he battled, and obviously made some throws.
I actually thought he had a pretty decent day. Now, there was – I personally, with my own loss, felt like I saw it. There was two touchdowns that he could have thrown to Brett Norfleet. I think there's one in the first half and then one in the second half. One in the first half, I'm trying to think who he went to, but – Norfleet looked like he was on somewhat of a wheel route or something like that. He was wide open. And then later in the second half, he had to step on his man and think Cook went straight to the goal line. I can't remember exactly who he was throwing it to, but he missed a couple of those throws. But I think, no, it doesn't surprise me that he ended up playing. I mean, this guy is kind of insane. I mean, going back to 2022, playing the whole season with a torn labrum and his throwing shoulder, I mean, that in itself is kind of crazy. So it's not a surprise that he played. I think he played, you know, pretty well. And again, 70 seconds away from leading a game-winning, two-score comeback for the second time in 4 weeks. That's how close they were. So he played pretty good, and I'm not surprised he found a way to play in the game.
The guy that we haven't talked about yet who put together just a spectacular performance was running back Nate Noel. He goes out, runs for 150 yards and a touchdown. He's been a little bit banged up recently. We haven't seen him impact the team, but it was on full display what he can do when healthy and how much he is able to impact the Tigers offensively.
Yeah, he opens up a different level in the run game as far as his shiftiness, his elusiveness, his ability to get out in space. I mean, his first step is incredible. It just felt like he was, you know, getting 5 yards per play. And I'm pretty sure he's running 5 or 6 yards per carry. I know there was a stretch on that second to last possession, the one that finishes with the burning touchdown, where four straight runs in a row, he got six yards. So, I mean, getting 24 yards on four straight carries when your team needs a touchdown, I mean, that's big time. So I had asked him earlier in the week how close he was to 100%, and he said he felt like he was pretty close, and he was. 27 for a buck 50 and a touchdown, I mean, that was huge. And the running backs, I think, were been doing all right with him, you know, kind of out of the lineup. But he kind of opens things up for the offense when he's on the field. I feel like he's usually the best or second best offensive player or position player, at least, on the field when he's healthy.
A lot of Mizzou fans that are listening to this right now probably don't feel great about a 7-3 season, especially because of the way two of those three losses went down against Texas A&M and also Alabama. But this couple winnable games coming up, Mississippi State has really struggled this year. Arkansas at home is winnable to finish out the year. This can still turn into a really, really good 9-3 season for this team.
Yeah, I mean, it could still be 9-3. I think that'll be the ninth time in school history that they have 9 wins. So, like, you can say you're disappointed, but saying it's a failure or a bad season, I think wouldn't be correct. I mean, that's not the case here. So you can get 9 wins, possibly, you know, you get in that bowl game, you get a 10th win. I think only two other times in history they've had back-to-back 10-win seasons. So if you can do that, that's a feat in itself. So I know the 12-team playoff gave so much hope, and thinking about how last year went and what would have happened if the playoff was that year and all that stuff. But, you know, I can't do nothing about it. But what you can do is you look at the games you got in front of you and say, what can you accomplish? And I asked Brady Cook after the game, kind of, I asked him about some of that stuff and what they can do going forward. And he was just like, we can focus on what's in front of us. So they're going to try to win out, try to get 9 wins, get that bowl game in, and try to get the 10th one and still make some type of history.
Jerrod Hamilton covers Mizzou football for Power Mizzou. It's still relatively new, you guys being affiliated with 24/7 Sports. How's that affiliation going for everybody at Power Mizzou?
It's awesome. I think we all like it. I mean, get a lot of help. We get to do a lot of different things with a lot of different sites and teams and stuff like that. Obviously, a lot more videos, podcasts, and all that stuff, and being able to talk about the Tigers on a bigger platform has been great and much easier and smoother than I expected. Because when you make a site change, you think there's all these things that got to go on that you have to do. And I think there's a little bit more work, but I think we all feel like we're getting a lot more out of it. So it's been good.
Again, powermizzou.com is the website. He is Jerrod Hamilton. Follow him on Twitter at Jerrod C. Hamilton. You spell Jerrod, J-A-R-O-D. Jerrod, thanks so much for your time. Hopefully we'll catch up again real soon.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you.
Awesome. Very good. Jerrod Hamilton joining us on the program. We appreciate him spending a few moments with us. Back-to-back guest here in the first hour of the program. Michael Yam covers the NFL for NFL Network, SiriusXM, and a few other outlets as well. I'll tell you what, this was a great football weekend. This was yesterday's action across the NFL was just really, really good from start to finish. We'll talk about that with Mike Yam and also get a bit of a preview of Monday Night Football. That's all coming up. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. It's a Graybar Sports Open Line here on KMOX. I'll tell you what, it was, man, it was a great NFL Sunday yesterday. Maybe the best of the year. The week is going to wrap up tonight with a game that on paper doesn't look great, Houston-Dallas, but I guess you never know what may end up happening. Right now, we're happy to be able to go to the guest line, and we welcome on to the program someone who covers the NFL for multiple outlets, including NFL Network, SiriusXM. He is Michael Yam. You follow him on Twitter at Mike_Yam. Mike, thanks so much for taking some time with us today. How are you?
Yeah, Matt, always appreciate the invite, man. And you're right. On paper, this looks a certain way, this type of game, but there is a reason why they play it, and who knows? Maybe Dallas does figure something out.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? Anytime things are going really, really bad, it feels like teams at some point are able to kind of, like, jump out of it. But maybe it hasn't gotten to its worst yet for the Cowboys. I don't know.
No, I'm with you. You know what's kind of crazy about this conversation? I was talking to a buddy of mine the other day, and he said, you know, the Lions should just hammer the Jags, right? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, the thing should be a bloodbath. It shouldn't be closed. And then the two of us started, like, just catching up about, you know, the teams and the rosters and the personnel. And obviously, Trevor Lawrence not playing, but Mac Jones has got starting experience. And we're sitting there going, can you imagine if? And then there's, like, that actual belief that, hey, maybe it could happen. I'm not suggesting that's the case tonight from a Dallas perspective, because I think Houston's playing for a lot right now. You know, the fact that they've had some stumbles, the fact that they could have 5 interceptions in a game against Jared Goff and still lose that game, those are the types of things where I think if I'm D'Amico Ryans, I'm pointing to, I'm saying, look, as we are in a funk right now, and this is an opportunity against a beaten-up Dallas Cowboys team that really shouldn't be in this game. Houston is a superior team. They have a superior roster. Their defense is better. And without Dak Prescott out on the football field, I don't know if they're in a running game that's been non-existent for most of the season. I just don't know the compelling argument for how you craft something based off of the evidence that says, hey, the Cowboys should win this game.
You've alluded to the Lions twice already, and with their big win yesterday combined with Kansas City's loss, Detroit is now the Super Bowl favorite, according to most sports books. Are the Lions the best team in the NFL?
Yeah, I lean that way, and I've leaned that way for a few weeks right now. I know even before the Kansas City loss, people were pointing to that team. I just wasn't necessarily sold. I think the Chiefs, obviously, if they win the Super Bowl this year, no one is going to be surprised by that. But I just think through the first, you know, weeks of the season, they've been playing with fire. You know, during, you know, the undefeated run, you know, they had 8 comeback wins during that stretch. I mean, that to me speaks volumes. They're not dominating teams. I think the Lions have shown they can beat you different ways. They can beat you in a game where Jared Goff doesn't throw for 100 yards. They can beat you in a game where he throws 5 interceptions. They can beat you, you know, defensively where, you know, their defense is not only creating turnovers but scoring. They can beat you in a special teams way. I think top to bottom, you know, that roster looks great. Now, once again, I think Kansas City is in that mix. I've been called out by some of my colleagues at NFL Network as I've been a Ravens defender. I think Baltimore still, on paper to me, has arguably the best roster in the NFL. And, you know, had they not had, you know, a fumble from Derrick Henry on the opening drive, 2 missed field goals and a missed 2-point conversion, you know, they beat Pittsburgh on the road on Sunday. So I think the Ravens are in the mix. I think Buffalo's got to be in that conversation. But to me, the Lions right now have shown to at least me, and I think the rest of the NFL world, that they are on paper right now probably the best team to in the league.
So yesterday, between two games, you had 4 teams that are all AFC championship game contenders. Ravens, Steelers one, yeah. Chiefs, Bills the other. You had a fantastic comeback from the Bengals on Sunday Night Football. The Chargers eventually win that game. The Packers-Bears game, the finish to that, a walk-off block is just crazy. Does it get any better from start to finish for an NFL Sunday than what we saw yesterday?
No, how awesome. And by the way, Matt, doesn't it feel like every year we're talking about results like this, talking about these crazy finishes coming down to the wire? I wish I knew. I'd forgotten stat. Last season, just the margin of victory. I mean, we were talking about a ridiculous amount of one-possession games. This season, same conversation that we're having. And candidly, even last night, and I know you mentioned it, but you know, at halftime, I'm sitting there going, Cincinnati ain't winning this game. Like, that's not going to happen for this team. And the run that they went on, I thought Collinsworth put it best, and I actually feel bad because I do a bunch of different shows at NFL Network. And, you know, Cincinnati's a team that I've been high on all year, and I've been disappointed, and I've tried to come up with the reasoning behind some of these close losses. But last night, for them to lose the way that they did, it not only is heartbreaking, but I don't know the path for them. I know the schedule lightens up, but they're going to need so much help to get into the postseason. But to your point, it's been an awesome year watching these games.
And I feel bad for the Bengals too, because they get that win. Man, they are right there. There's a path for them to get there, and they're a very scary team going into the playoffs. Instead, I hate to put all the blame on a kicker, but you got a kicker who misses a couple field goals. Either one of them would have probably won the game for them, and we're having this conversation today.
You know what's wild about some of these end of game situations? The kicking game, we've almost taken for granted that these guys are executing, because, you know, when I was growing up, you know, a 50-yarder was like, whoa, that's insane. Now you got dudes that are going plus 50, and it looks easy. Mm-hmm. And then I've seen some performances. Look, Justin Tucker, one of those guys, we've talked about him as maybe the best kicker in NFL history. He's had a little bit of a rough season. Young Wei Koo with the Falcons has had some misses, which have broken my heart a little bit. And then last night, you know, to your point, to close out, but then also to get an opportunity late in that game. They got the ball back, and I'm thinking, oh, Joe Cool's going to deliver in this game, and they still lose. And I think, to me, that's what, you know, is the sign also of you know, being a good team. Like, when the Chiefs were running this season before yesterday's loss, I'm sitting there, and I made this analogy to a couple friends of mine. I was like, you know, it feels like the Yankees of the 90s when they're winning these World Series, right? Like, all of these things that need to happen and go in their favor are just sort of dropping into their lap. And that was how the Chiefs season has gone so far this season. But the good teams figure out ways to get it done, and the Chargers last night against Cincinnati, with their backs against the wall, you know, they got it done.
We spend so much time talking Chiefs, Bills, Steelers, Ravens in the AFC. That Chargers team is going to be a tough out in the playoffs, assuming they get there.
Oh, man. Tell me the squad that is not going to be scared going up against that team. I know you obviously watched the game, and I'm sure a lot of, you know, the guys listening right now and the gals that are listening who are paying attention, did you guys notice that defense is swarming? Mm-hmm. They do not miss tackles. It felt like every time a guy had a reception, first of all, Joe Burrow was under duress, so I give a ton of credit to the pressure that the Chargers were able to generate, but it just felt like they were everywhere. And it reminded me a little bit of the Ravens defense from last season. They look fast. They don't miss tackles. It's swarming to the football. they play this thing dirty. And Justin Herbert all of a sudden is starting to find a little bit of a groove here, and that running game is strong. Like the Chargers are, I think the Chargers and the Eagles are probably the two teams that we don't talk enough about nationally. I think there's some people that might push back maybe on the Eagles thing, but you know, in my mind, I just sort of felt like the Eagles were a little forgotten. I think now, because of Saquon's performances, they're becoming a little bit more discussed.
Well, they have a track record too. Like that's a smart organization, and I know they only won two of their first four games, but haven't they earned and don't they deserve a little bit of grace even if they have a 2-2 start?
Totally. And on top of that, think about the injuries that team has had to overcome. And look, there's every team, and you know, people will be like, Mike, every team in the NFL's got injuries. I get that, but there's some teams that completely collapse. You know, and I'm not saying that was the case for them. In fact, they started winning once they got healthy again. But I give a lot of credit to a team like Tampa Bay. I mean, tell me the team that can navigate the amount of injuries to key personnel at the skill position spot and still make it interesting. Now, they haven't won these games, and I get that. But my God, like down the stretch, they have an opportunity. And I think there's a lot of teams in the NFL that don't have the moxie, don't have the mental fortitude, and really the depth to compete when stars go down. And once again, I get it. Tampa Bay hasn't won some of these games, but they're an organization that I point to that says, hey, not folding, and had an opportunity to win some of these matchups, even without the likes of Evans and Godwin.
Last thing for you, we're talking with Michael Yam, NFL Network. The Giants announced that Daniel Jones is being benched, their quarterback. He goes to their third-string spot. They do that to protect themselves against injury so they can get out from under that contract at the end of the season. But they go to Tommy DeVito as opposed to Drew Lock. We've seen some good things from Lock during his career. Is this a clear – is this a combination tank job and also protection job with Jones? Just the way this whole decision process goes on, it feels like this isn't what's the best for the NFL.
Yeah, Matt, I'm the worst person to ask this question to, because when you bring up the Giants, there's like the fan cap that I'm trying to take off while I answer this question, because I grew up in northern New Jersey and I went to school and college in New York, so I'm a Giants fan, and this has been tough. I'd be lying if I said to you, like, I'm okay with them getting a really high draft pick, and, you know, hopefully they're going to be able to, you know, pick one of these top-ranked quarterbacks, whether it's a Cam Ward or Shedeur Sanders. I think there's, you know, a pretty decent chance that, and they're going to be picking in that top three, and I'll have their say. You know, that said, look, Tommy Cutlets is a great story. You know, went to high school, you know, one of my rival high schools, just not too far from Giant Stadium in New Jersey. But, you know, to me, I think the one thing that the league really thrives on is, you know, having its stars out there. And the problem is right now that there's just so many questions around what this offense could look like. And I think there's going to be changes in New York. I'd be heartbroken if Brian Daboll loses his job. And I know the job that Joe Shane has done. He's under the microscope because of the way Saquon Barkley has played and them not being able to get there. The only pushback, and once again, I wanted them to get a deal done with Saquon. They made an offer. They made multiple offers, and they couldn't. It didn't get done with Saquon. He's playing the best football of his entire career. Like, this looks like, you know, a better version of 2018 Saquon, which makes all of this conversation tougher. But Daniel Jones, there's been times where I don't think it's his fault on the football field. And there are other times that there's these head-scratching moments. But I do wish that, you know, the Giants hopefully are just in a situation to compete at a high level. And Daboll's got to feel like, you know what, maybe Tommy Cutlets gives us the best chance.
Michael Yam covers the NFL, NFL Network, SiriusXM on Twitter, at Mike_Yam. Mike, appreciate you taking some time. This is great stuff. Hopefully we can catch up again in the future.
Anytime. Really appreciate it, Matt. Thanks again.
Awesome. Very good. That's Michael Yam joining us on the program. Appreciate him spending a moment or so with us. Again, I thought yesterday was great. I thought yesterday was one of those days where you just sit down on the couch and you watch good game after, and you finally get to the final game, Sunday Night Football, and it looks like it's going to be a stinker, and then boom, the Bengals turn it on, and that just turned into an amazing game with great drama. Like sometimes we like to talk about, like, when one team gets up really big and then the other team makes a big comeback, that's a great game. A lot of times those aren't actually great games. It's a great comeback. but it's a stinker of a game because one team is up by a ton and then another team slowly but surely gets back into it, but they're only into it for, you know, really back into it. It's only like a competitive game for the final few moments of the game. That's not a good game. There's good moments, a good comeback. The thing that was interesting about Sunday Night Football last night was it was the scenario where one team gets up big and the other team starts coming back, but it truly turned into a great game because you had the drama of the missed kicks. You had each team with opportunities late with drives. You know, Cincinnati did just enough, I guess, there in the first half kind of to make you feel like maybe they could do something. So that turned into a great game as well. It was a great day in the NFL yesterday. One more break. We will come back and we'll wrap up hour number one of the program. My name is Matt Pauley. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Back at it here on KMOX. It is a Graybar Sports Open Line. I wanted to talk a little bit of time here in this final segment. I don't have enough time to get into it quite as much as I wanted to, so we'll probably extend it over into the 7 o'clock hour. I'd be curious to hear from you. You can text in if you would like at 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. Did you watch the Mike Tyson Jake Paul fight? And were you anything other than completely disappointed by it? I mean, they got people to watch. I guess we should have known what was going to come out of it. I was disappointed in it. I am of the belief that there was a gentleman's agreement between Tyson and Paul on the way it was going to go down. I'm not using the word fixed, but I think it essentially was just that. And it was for those of us who like remember Tyson for who Mike Tyson was, it was kind of disappointing. It was fun to see him, but that fun ended very, very quickly. So I want to spend a little bit of time on this. I was watching it on Sunday night. Again, if you've got any thoughts on it, we'll welcome your text messages in at 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. Something like 65 million people tuned into that thing, or at least attempted to tune into that thing. It floors me that a company like Netflix can't figure out live streaming. And I know the anti-streaming people out there are like using this as an opportunity to puff out their chest. You know who doesn't have a problem? And admittedly, maybe if they had an event that had 65 million people watching it, maybe it'd be different. But all we did last week was talk about how this is going to be the boxing match with the biggest audience ever in the history of boxing, which is kind of sad when we say that. But Netflix should have known what the audience was going to be or what it could be, and they should have had the technology ready to go. If you watch a game, a soccer game or a baseball game on Apple TV, this doesn't happen. If you watch a football game on Peacock, this doesn't happen. I watched the Blues, one of the Blues games. It was their game against the Sabres on Friday. That was on Hulu. I watched it on Hulu. There's no issue there. Like, across the board, when I was watching NFL football yesterday, I was down in my office in my basement where I get horrible TV reception and just have a little streaming device on my TV. So I watched it on Paramount Plus. No problem there. So I don't understand why all these other streaming services, which we think of as being kind of lesser compared to Netflix, they have no problem getting the streaming thing figured out, but Netflix can't. And now Netflix has an NFL doubleheader that's going to be coming up on Christmas. We'll continue to talk through this Tyson-Paul fight. We'll do that after the 7 o'clock news here on KMOX.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Alo, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on King of OX.
Back at it as we continue on to Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. Have you for another hour. Then tonight at 8 o'clock, it is the Gas House Gang. Myself, Tom Ackerman, Kevin Wheeler, Bernie Miklas will be rolling your way. It is a Monday. That means it's a Cardinals Monday, and we do nothing but Cardinals baseball. So make sure to be tuned in for that beginning at 8 o'clock this evening right here on KMOX. So Saturday night. Friday night, it was the Mike Tyson fight as he matched up against Jake Paul. And, man, everybody was talking about it. I give Netflix and the promoters of this fight all the credit in the world because they drummed up a lot of interest for a fight between a dude who's basically 60 and a guy who is a social media influencer and hasn't taken a legit fight yet in his professional boxing career. I think people like me, and I think a lot of people would agree with this, we were all kind of hoping that we would see, for just a split second, a flash of old school Mike Tyson. The Mike Tyson that, you know, people, I'm 42 years old. People like me, people a little bit older than me, the Mike Tyson that we grew up watching, the baddest man on the planet. And some of these training videos that came out of Tyson leading up to it, it was like, okay, this guy looks like the real deal. Now, admittedly, those training videos were like 13 seconds long, but it's still, you saw some pretty good movement in there. And then this darn thing starts, and Tyson won like the first round. He got a few punches in there, but it was just, to me, it was a sham. It was a complete and total sham. But again, it was a dude who was almost 60 fighting. Like, is the sham on them putting it on, or is the sham on me watching it and expecting something? I'm having this internal battle. Kyle Sixta in studio with us. I'm having this internal battle, Kyle, where I keep trying to convince myself that it was actually completely and totally fixed and staged, because even at close to 60, Mike Tyson would still absolutely destroy Jake Paul. That's what I want to believe. I don't know if it's true or not.
I think that's what everyone wants to believe. I think everyone in their heart, they want to believe that Mike Tyson still has it, even at age 58.
Yeah, has something. And there's been a few videos that have made their way around on social media. Like, there's one time early on where Tyson lands a punch, Paul's backing up into the corner, Paul's like fist are down, so his face is wide open. And Tyson doesn't go after him. And then, like, Paul, like, almost sticks his tongue out at him.
I did see
after that. And it's like, I don't know. It's moments like those that make me feel like, okay, maybe there was a gentleman's agreement before this thing even got started that they would just go ahead and take it the distance and laugh all the way to the bank. But again, I'm talking about a guy who's darn near 60 years old who hasn't had a competitive boxing match in like 20 years. So I don't know.
Yeah, I completely agree. Moments like that do make you wonder about the fight and its legitimacy. But at the same time, if Mike Tyson were going to win this fight, I assume it would have had to be knockout in the first couple rounds because, again, he is 58.
Were you able to watch it?
I watched like the highlights of it.
Okay.
I struggled with the Netflix connection. I wasn't able to really get clear like visuals of the fight, so I kind of just said forget it, but I did watch highlights afterwards.
Yeah, the video quality was terrible.
So bad.
Even if you got it, the video quality was terrible. What I did at one point, I saw somebody else mention this on social media, and I tried it. So all night long, I would like start it, and I would get the little spinning circle that would say it would be stuck at 25%, or I would get a Netflix error where I have to restart, or Netflix would just completely restart on its own. That was like the trifecta. Like 90% of the time when I tried to get to it, I would get one of those three things. Somebody said to pause it and let like a minute go by and then restart it. And I did that. And from that point forward, I was able to stay with it. The stream stayed consistent. Horrible video quality, but the stream did stay consistent. So I was able to see it. The bigger point here in all of this, and we alluded to it a few moments ago, Netflix has two NFL games on Sunday, on Christmas Day. And if the NFL and Roger Goodell and all parties involved are not concerned about what occurred with this fight, I'd be shocked. I mean, there has to be some type of assurance from Netflix that they have the infrastructure to be able to handle that kind of audience watching a couple NFL games.
I mean, there's got to be. And if I'm Netflix, you got to be doing everything you can from now until Christmas Day when you have those two NFL games to make sure you got it figured out.
Yeah. I don't know. How is Netflix so bad at this?
I don't get it.
How is Netflix so... They are great at everything, and they have more money than God, and they spend it everywhere, and they go do these big things, but every single time they have a live streaming event... They had there was like a reality show live stream that they were trying to do like a year ago on like a Sunday night, and that I don't remember exactly what that was. Wasn't there a live comedy show? Was it Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle?
Maybe.
Somebody was there supposed to be a live comedy show. I think it was Chris Rock. I might be wrong on that. It might have been Dave Chappelle. Either way, people couldn't log into that exact same issue. So this is the third time where Netflix has attempted to do a live stream and they've just fallen flat on their faces.
I guess we'll see on December 25th.
You did not know the St. Louis connection to the fight.
I didn't.
So if you follow along on social media, the ring girls for the fight got a whole lot of attention. And there was one ring girl in particular who got a lot of attention on social media, a ring girl by the name of Sydney Thomas. Now, there is a pretty good chance that you have seen Sydney Thomas before without even watching boxing or following along with her social media or anything like that. Sydney Thomas is the daughter of Todd Thomas, who is... that one guy, the you know, in-game MC for Cardinals games, and his daughter sometimes is with him. I think she's a college student now at Alabama or something like that. But she got a lot of attention for all the ring girls did, but she got a lot of attention. And as there hasn't really been much media locally in St. Louis about the St. Louis connection, because she's part of, like, I don't know if it's Team Fredbird or what she does, but I know there was at least one time this past year because somebody pointed her out to me. I guess she's got a pretty large social media presence, and she does a lot of professional modeling and things like that. And she was doing stuff with her dad one game for the in-game stuff, and somebody pointed her out to me and said she also does this other stuff and showed me some of her social media. But yeah, that is the St. Louis connection. So if you are one of the many, many people that were enthralled by the ring girls during the Tyson Paul fight, you can know that you have likely seen that person before at a Cardinals game doing Team Fredbird and stuff, and that her dad is Todd Thomas, who again does a great job with all the in-game stuff and has done it for, when I think about it, I mean, I don't know how many years he has been doing this now, but I think back to when I was growing up going to Cardinals games, he was there. Like, I have a hard time remembering Cardinals baseball without him being the in-game MC, and he just keeps doing it. And he doesn't age. He looks like the exact same guy that he was years and years and years ago. So good on him for that. But kind of a fun St. Louis connection to that, to the Tyson Paul fight this past week. And as again, she is just blown up on social media. I didn't realize it was her. I had no clue. Like, I can't just like recognize her. I had no clue that that's who it was. When I saw ring girls, I just assumed they were probably people who were local to Dallas and were, you know, whatever. And then if you're on social media, like, you couldn't not see it. Like, there were so many people talking about them. And then I saw the name. I said, I know that name. And I figured it out that that's who it was. So there is your St. Louis connection to the Tyson Paul fight.
There we go.
All right. When we return, we are going to talk through the Hall of Fame ballot that was released earlier today. Do we have a chance for some first balloters? I think so. We'll go through that coming up in just a moment. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Back at it here on KMOX. It is a Graybar Sports Open Line. Appreciate you being with us this evening. If you want to chime in, you can do so calling, texting, tweeting, 314-436-7900. You can also tweet at me. It's at Matt Pauley on air, MattPauley on air. Baseball was announced, the Baseball Hall of Fame announcing the newest Baseball Hall of Fame ballot. And there's some interesting names on this list of potential candidates to get into the Hall of Fame. I think there's a couple guys who, and look, I'm not breaking any news here. A couple guys who I would say are likely to be first ballot Hall of Famers in Ichiro Suzuki and CC Sabathia. They are among the 14 new candidates on the Hall of Fame ballot, joining 14 holdovers. So the other first-timers that are on this list, Felix Hernandez, Carlos Gonzalez, Dustin Pedroia, Hanley Ramirez, Fernando Rodney, Ian Kinsler, Ben Zobrist, Troy Tulowitzki, Russell Martin, Brian McCann, Curtis Granderson, and Adam Jones. Kyle Sixta, do you... can we just both assume that Ichiro and CC are in?
They're in.
Okay. Of the other 12 first-timers on the ballot, do you hear any names that are clearly and obviously Hall of Famers?
Oh, man. I don't think there's any that stick out to me that immediately say first ballot. Maybe down the line a couple of those guys get close, but I don't think this year besides those two.
I think you can make an argument for Carlos Gonzalez. And I think the way things have gone recently, and I don't think me saying you can make the argument for and me saying that I think somebody is are very two different things. I don't think Carlos Gonzalez is a Hall of Famer, but one of the things that has happened in recent years with both Todd Helton and Larry Walker getting in, it feels like the anti-Colorado bias has started to go away a little bit, and I'm really glad to see that. Like as somebody who spent 6 years broadcasting AAA baseball at the elevation of beyond what even Coors Field is, I never thought it was fair that those players got dinged for, you know, playing their games in Colorado. So you look at Carlos Gonzalez's numbers, I think you can find a way to make the argument. Same thing kind of with Dustin Pedroia. He would be probably the other guy on that list. I think there's going to be some affection towards Curtis Granderson. Granderson did it for a really long time and had some really big moments. I don't think his numbers stand up to Hall of Fame status. Troy Tulowitzki, another Colorado guy, if he would have stayed healthy, he was on a Hall of Fame track for a while.
He was.
And then his career just got derailed. And this is a situation where I think playing in Colorado was actually really bad for him because I just playing the shortstop position at the I'm a believer in, I heard Houston Street talk about this once. So Houston Street was pitching for Colorado, ended up going to San Diego. And I remember reading something where he said, you know, when you live and you are very athletic in Colorado, you know, doing things every day, you wake up some mornings and you hurt in certain areas and you have no clue why. And then he talked about going to San Diego and he would wake up every morning and he would feel great. And I'm not trying to get all like medical and physiological here. I don't think we actually know the impact of altitude on the human body completely. And I hear things like that. So Tulowitzki playing the way he played, he was a big dude. I think in many ways, we can look at the evolution of the shortstop position, and we look at O'Neill Cruz isn't a shortstop anymore, but we can, you know, somebody like him, a big-bodied shortstop. There's other Ellie De Cruz, bigger type guy. We see a lot more of those bigger, power-hitting shortstops. It started with Tulo. Tulo was like the dude who did that first, and then all of a sudden, more guys started coming in after that.
He really was, and I remember in the beginning of his career watching him, and everyone was like, he's going to be a third baseman. Yeah. Like, no way he sticks at short, and he just always did.
We might be talking about him as a Hall of Famer if he would have gone over to third.
Who knows?
That's a little bit less. And even after he left Colorado, I mean, he never got on track. He went to Toronto.
He went to Toronto,
yeah. And couldn't stay healthy there. And
he was
then
a Yankee, I think.
Was he? Okay. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, he just called it quits and he retired. And really disappointing into his career, because like I said, he absolutely at one point was on track to be a Hall of Famer, and he just could not stay healthy. Ian Kinsler with ties to the area. He's a Mizzou guy. He's on the list. I don't know. I don't know if a single one of these guys will become a Hall of Famer outside of Ichiro and CC Sabathia.
I think one guy that maybe has a chance is Felix Hernandez, maybe. Just because, you know, when you think of pitchers early 2010s, late 2000s, Felix comes to mind. He had the perfect game, so maybe that has something to do with it. And I just feel like there's a lot of guys in this class that if injuries hadn't derailed them, they would be looking at a much better shot.
100%. Yeah, Brian McCann's an interesting case as a catcher. He was really good for a fair amount of time. I mean, he was somebody who he just kind of showed up every day. Like, that's one of those guys that, you know, the way Scott Rolen started really low on the list and just slowly got more and more votes. I could see a scenario where it plays out that way for Brian McCann.
I could see that too. He raked. He was good.
Yeah, he was good. Fine. He was perfectly fine defensive catcher. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's it. As far as the returners, the big one is Billy Wagner. Last year, he came up just 5 votes short of the 75% needed. There's got to be 5 more votes somewhere for Wagner. There has to be.
There's got to be.
Yeah, so I feel like there's a very good chance that this next Hall of Fame class is going to be Ichiro, CC, and Wagner. Some of the other holdovers, Alex Rodriguez, he's connected to steroids, so he's not going to get enough votes. Manny Ramirez, connected to steroids, he's not going to get enough votes. The Andrew Jones, there's a lot of people who would die on the Andrew Jones hill that he's a Hall of Famer. Are you on that?
I don't have a super strong opinion. I would lean towards yes.
Okay, I lean yes too. I look at Andrew Jones's numbers and I say this guy is a Hall of Famer. Go compare Andrew Jones to Jim Edmonds. And what I don't get is why Edmonds falls off so quickly and Jones has stayed on, because their numbers are really comparable. And there are some really loud voices out there for Andrew Jones should be a Hall of Famer, and we never heard those voices for Jim Edmonds.
Yeah, that's a good point. In that era, probably the best 2 defensive center fielders playing.
I mean, I don't completely get that. Maybe they come back around on Edmonds with the Eras Committee at some point. I don't know, but that's been interesting to me. Carlos Beltran, I think he's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
I do. And last time he only got 57%. Is he connected? Does he have he doesn't have a PED thing connected to him, does he?
I don't think so, but for some reason, something is sticking in my head.
The Astros thing.
Oh, maybe that's definitely it. Yeah. I think he's good on PED.
Okay.
I think it's just the Astros.
Is it just the Astros thing that's keeping him? Because he was at 57%. That seems like a low number. And I think we should differentiate between what somebody does, like in their playing career, versus what they're connected to later on. I don't know. I should go back and listen to what I had to say this time last year when we were talking about him, because that seems like a really low number. Other holdovers, guys who aren't going to get in, Chase Utley, Omar Vizquel, Jimmy Rollins. There's an argument for Rollins, by the way. If he would have been who he was at the peak of his career for a longer amount of time, there's that argument. Bobby Abreu, Andy Pettit, Mark Burley, Francisco Rodriguez, Torrey Hunter, David Wright. David Wright's another guy. Injuries. He was on a Hall of Fame track. He absolutely was on a Hall of Fame track at one point. Gary Sheffield was dropped off the ballot in his 10th and final year. He dropped after receiving just under 64%. He's a Hall of Famer to me, 100%. 100% a Hall of Famer. And that's where everything is at.
I agree.
All right. So we'll see. We'll see where everything goes with this. Again, I think I would, if the old proverbial gun to the head, if somebody had to get my prediction, I would say in all likelihood, this next Hall of Fame class from this group of players that I mentioned, it's going to be Ichiro. It's going to be CC Sabathia. And then I do think Wagner ends up getting the final votes that he has to get to be able to get in. But these are fun conversations. I always like, and there's people out there, you know, maybe we should try to get Jay Jaffe on this week. He's somebody that when it comes to Hall of Fame voting, there is nobody out there who, I mean, he literally wrote the book on it. Would be interesting to get his thoughts on which guys should be in and which guys shouldn't. He spends a lot of time advising folks on who they need to be voting for. And we are getting to a point where the group of people who are electing these is changing a little bit. There's more and more younger writers who are hitting the 10-year mark. So once you're a baseball writers member for 10 years, that's when you get the ability to have a vote. So we're seeing some of the older writers kind of fall off, and we're seeing some of the younger writers come in. As this has started to happen, though, what I have found interesting is the writers have continued to be very, very clear when it comes to people who are connected to steroids. You know, for a while, like when we talked about Mark McGwire and Barry Bonds and guys like that, the thought was always that if these guys can stay on the ballot long enough, that maybe the view on who they are and what they did will change based off the age of the writers and the younger writers starting to get voting rights. That really has not happened. I mean, most of those guys have fallen off, and the ones who have not fallen off, the A-Rods, they are just not getting the votes that they need to be able to get in there. So that's the group that is going to be considered, and we'll see how many of them actually do end up getting in. 314-436-7900. That's how you call. That's how you text. You can tweet at me at Matt Pauley on air, MattPauley on air. We've got still a lot more coming up here in this next half hour. We're going to keep with baseball and baseball awards. The Rookie of the Year honors have been officially announced, and we'll tell you who picked up those honors, and I'll give you my thoughts. We'll get Kyle's thoughts on them as well, because we had a disagreement on this when we were talking about it a couple weeks ago. Turns out Kyle was right. I was not right in what I was thinking, and we'll go through that coming up in just a moment. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. 25 minutes left in the program. It's a Graybar Sports Open Line. We take you until 8 o'clock. At 8 o'clock, it is the Gas House Gang, as I will be joined by Tom Ackerman, Kevin Wheeler, and Bernie Miklas for our Cardinal Monday edition of the program. If you're not familiar with the Gas House Gang, I know we talk about it a lot, but want to continue to let you know your ways of taking it in. In addition to listening to it most weeknights at 8 o'clock here on KMOX, it is a video program that begins at 12 noon each day that you can watch on the various KMOX Sports, KMOX News social media channels, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Facebook, whether it's YouTube. If you can't watch it live at noon, if you do watch it live at noon, we've got the opportunity for you to comment and everything, and we can respond to that. But if you don't, you can just head to YouTube and go to KMOX Sports and find it for yourself. And we do that every day. So Monday, it's all four of us. And then the rest of the week, we pair off. I believe tomorrow is Tom and Kevin. Wednesday is myself and Tom. Thursday, I believe, is Kevin and Bernie, and then me and Bernie on Friday. So that has been the schedule each week. Not that we are beholden to that schedule, but that's the way it has been here recently. But we've got today's edition of the program coming up at 8 o'clock. We talk a lot about the personality of the Cardinals. And I don't think the personality of the Cardinals has ever been more important than where it is right now, because this is a team that you don't know how many wins they're going to get this year. I think I am a little bit more positive about this year's edition of the Cardinals than most people. You know, I think the Cardinals are setting expectations a little bit lower. That's just what's going to happen when one of the main narratives and talking points of an offseason has been lowering payroll. And they're still going to lower a little bit more. I think there's still some guys that I would expect that they're going to end up moving. But I think there are some young guys who have the opportunity to be pretty special players. And this team is, how do I put this? I really, really like Paul Goldschmidt. I really, really like Nolan Arenado. I've said this before, go back a couple years ago. Arenado is one of those guys that if you're starting a franchise from the beginning, he's the guy I'm choosing. He is somebody who I've thought so highly of throughout his career. That being said, like when you think about that clubhouse and you think about some of the things that have happened in the clubhouse the past 2 years, and not even just with those two guys. I mean, you go back a couple years ago when Wilson Contreras all of a sudden isn't a catcher anymore because some of the veteran pitchers evidently weren't real happy with what was going on. And, you know, the veteran pitching group at that point was folks like Adam Wainwright and Jack Flaherty and Miles Michaelis was in that group as well. And they eventually worked that out. But you just think about kind of some of the veterans who have been with the Cardinals post Molina Pujols and what their personalities have looked like and how their personalities impacted the team. They really didn't have these big personalities. And John Mozeliak was on with Tom Ackerman. I meant to pull the cut. I'll do that tomorrow. We'll pull a little bit from Mo and play back what you said, and I'll give you my comments. But because I'll paraphrase him now, but I want to make sure to get it fully right. So we'll get it straight from his mouth when we talk about it tomorrow. But essentially, Mo said that they are looking to be a much more athletic, energetic sort of team. And you know, who is that? Like, because we can say all these things. Something that I've been discussing a lot recently is the fact that we can talk all we want about opportunities for younger players. Where are those opportunities really coming? Right now, all the Cardinals have really done to create opportunities for younger players is at the catcher spot. That's really the only spot that clearly right now is going to be given to younger players because Wilson Contreras is going to be your first baseman. So Von Herrera and Pedro Páez are you guys catching. Now, if Nolan Arenado moves on, there's going to be an opportunity there. But when Contreras went over to first base, that blocked a Lucan Baker, that blocked a Alec Burleson from getting as much time at first base. So you can say all you want about opportunities for young guys. So far, I don't think the roster decisions that have been made so far, nothing, you know, no big decisions have been made. I don't think they're just creating and opening up these clear, not, you know, positions for young guys. And I would still put Nolan Gorman in the young guy category. If they end up trading Nolan Arenado, my assumption would be that Gorman's going to be the first guy to be given the opportunity to play at third base. You've got other people who can do that job. Brendan Donovan can play at third base. Thomas Tejesi can play at third base. I would think that the way that would all play out is Gorman would be given that first opportunity. And speaking of Gorman, John Denton wrote newsletter, but the excerpt from the newsletter is available at MLB.com and Cardinals.com. He actually wrote a little bit about how Brant Brown and Nolan Gorman have already connected, that they live fairly close to each other in the Phoenix area, so they've already been able to get together and work on some things. That's good news. I think the more I learn about Brant Brown, the more I get excited about his ability to help younger hitters become better versions of who they've been. And that continues to be my big kick about this. I want the Cardinals to bring good, great. No, I don't want them very good. I want them to bring great people into the organization and for it to be an iron sharpens iron situation. Let everybody, you know, if I'm going to use cliches, you know, the whole the rising tide deal, like let's do that. Let everybody can get better together. And it started bringing in somebody like Chaim Bloom, and then it continues like bringing in a Rob Serfolio, and now I'm hopeful that the additions on the coaching staff, most notably Brant Brown, will be, and John Jay as well. I'm not trying to be dismissive of him. I hope just everybody that was brought in is able to do that. But yeah, you talk about who's the face of the team, and if they want to be young and they want to be, you know, energetic and athletic and all those things, you have Mason Winn. He's all that, and in many ways he's become one of the faces of the team. We've talked about it on this show. I think if you're a 12-year-old kid who's just starting to fall in love with the Cardinals, the player that you're probably most likely to kind of, you know, gravitate towards is Mason Winn. He's that guy. I think if Victor Scott wins the center fielder's job out of spring, he falls under that category. There's other guys on the way. J.J. Weatherholt's going to be here before we know it. Quinn Matthews is going to be here before we know it. Jimmy Crooks is going to be here before we know it. There's the next core of this team. There's some really exciting names. I mean, you think about the people who have already arrived, like Sejacy, like Wynn, and then you add in a Matthews, you add in a Hintz, you add in a Crooks, you add in a Weatherholt. No guarantee that these players are going to turn into something, but this organization has not done a fantastic job at just giving opportunities to young guys and giving them a job. They finally did it with Mason Wynn. They finally did it with Mason Wynn. And obviously Wynn's ability and talent and skill and everything just jumped off the page. But if we go back to spring training this past year, what was the narrative? What were we being told on an everyday basis? The shortstop job is Mason Wynn's job. It basically doesn't matter what he does offensively. This is his job. And that really worked. That worked pretty darn well, right? We can all agree with that. So this is the year to do that. This is the year to say, third base is Nolan Gorman's job. Right field is Jordan Walker's job. A starter spot when Quinn Matthews ready. This is his job. You know, sometimes with this organization, because the bottom line is they've always been trying to win at the highest level, even in years where maybe they don't have the roster to be able to do that, there has been that pressure. I think that pressure existed this past year. That pressure existed 2 years ago. I talked about the Wilson Contreras thing a moment ago. If you're not really playing for anything, then that Contreras thing doesn't play out the way. And that was a terrible year. That happened during a terrible year. And it still ended up happening because there's always been this feeling of you got to go out and get as many wins as you possibly can. And wins as in wins and losses, not wins as in shortstop, Mason Wynn. But this year, it seems like the year where there's going to be opportunity given to more younger players if they follow through with this. And I think that's a good thing, because if you are able to play loose and just play with the confidence that you're going to, you have a job pretty much no matter what, that goes a really long way. But yeah, the identity of a team where a city and a group of fans can kind of unite behind them beyond just wins and losses, beyond just, I guess style of play does go into it at times. You know, there are teams that have big identities, but it's okay to have fun. It's okay to have something stupid in the dugout that gets passed around every time a home run is hit. It's okay to have different celebrations that you do. And then the Cardinals dabble in that a little bit, but at times things are a little bit stodgy. And it's okay to say, even though I get it, they are the St. Louis Cardinals. They are the St. Louis Cardinals. I get that. They are above other teams in terms of history and decorum and all that sort of stuff. And I'm not completely trying to run away from that, but it's okay to have fun, because, you know, it's a chicken and egg sort of thing. Like, if you're winning, you're having fun. Well, how do you have fun when you're not winning? And I know there's going to be some people who, if the team is getting, you know, their brains beat in, and you see a video of somebody in the dugout and they're laughing, there's going to be people talking about how bad of a look that is. But I want my guys, I want my players walking into the ballpark every day with a smile on their face and loving what they're doing. And if that means they've got a smile on their face when the team is losing by 10-2 score in the fifth inning, so be it. Because I think the team that's having fun every day is a team that in the long run is going to end up winning more games. And I think it's a team that fans will be able to connect to better. Again, this goes back to what I said a moment ago. Mason Wynn is the guy right now that I think a lot of younger fans connect to. You need more than just one guy. You need, and I, with all due respect to the veterans on this team, I don't think they were overly connectable players. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up this edition. I'll get to the Rookie of the Year stuff, which I was planning to do on this segment, and I got caught off guard by that. But we'll discuss it and get out of here in just a moment here on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Gray Bar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on King of OX.
Back at it for just a few more moments before we make way for the Gas House Gang. That rolls away from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. Bernie Miklas, Kevin Wheeler, Tom Ackerman, myself, talking all things Cardinals baseball. And that's going to get started here in just a few moments. This is qualifying offer season, and a little bit of a surprise. Nick Martinez, right-hand pitcher, was given the qualifying offer by the Cincinnati Reds. He accepted it. So he's going to make just over $21 million with the Reds this upcoming season. This past year, he was really good. 10-7, 3.10 ERA, had 16 starts, 42 overall games. Kyle, you and I were kind of joking earlier about this. Like, this almost feels like the Reds issuing the qualifying offer, hoping that he wouldn't accept it so they could get a draft pick out of it. And then jokes on the Reds. He's going to go ahead and take his $21 million for the year.
Yeah, I think they were trying to steal a draft pick there and hoping he went to another team and they get the pick and he goes elsewhere and they don't have to pay him. And I mean, if I'm Nick Martinez, why not? It's $21 million. Yeah. I'm taking that.
Yeah, absolutely. And he is now there's a lot of time left in the offseason, but his salary for next season with the Reds is now $6.5 million more than any other player on the road. This is going to sound like I'm taking a shot at Nick Martinez. I'm not. I'm taking a shot at the Reds. If Nick Martinez is the highest paid player on your roster, you're not good. You're not good. You're not. And look, I like a lot of the young players for the Reds, and I was bummed on their behalf and for their fans that they dealt with so many injuries this past season, because that's a team that could have maybe taken a step forward. They've got so many young, exciting, fun players, but Nick Martinez can't make $21.5 million and the next highest paid player is at 15. Like, that's just, so yeah, I'll be curious to see what happens. I cannot believe that the Reds are overly comfortable with that. Did get a couple awards announced. This is going to be something that we'll be talking about all week long. Paul Skeens named the National League Rookie of the Year Award. He is able to beat out Jackson Merrill from the Padres. Those two players combined to receive every single first and second place vote. So every voter who did not vote for Skeens to be in first place voted for him to be in second. And for every voter who did not vote Merrill second, voted him first. And then Jackson Churio ends up third on that list. So two of the three coming from the National League Central, Skeens and then Churio. And then from a American League side of things, Luis Gill beats out Austin Wells and Colton Cowser to win the award. So different. Like, so many great young players in the National League. Mason Winn doesn't even receive a single vote. And I'm okay with that. You look at the other guys on the list, and as much as I like Mason Winn, I get it. I understand why nobody was voting for him. Like I said earlier, you put Mason Winn's season and put it in the American League. Does he beat out Luis Gill? Maybe. He's right there. I mean, he is definitely top three, if not winning it this year in the American League. And there have certainly been some years in the National League where he would have won it as well. So a little bit of a disappointment when it came to that. But here we are. All right, Gas House Gang, on the way next. Don't go anywhere. Bernie Miklas, Kevin Wheeler, Tom Ackerman, myself. It is a Cardinals Monday. Nothing but Cardinals talk beginning after the 7 o'clock news, 8 o'clock news here on KMOX.